Hey guys and gals, James here with a quick note at the top of the show to let you know that we're going to be taking a holiday break just like last year, so there'll be no new episode on the 26th. Episode 50 will go live on January 9th, 2018, and will help us to better align with SIHH and with other travel concerns over the holidays. So happy holidays from Jason and I, please be well, and we'll chat to you soon in 2018. On with the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 49, and we thank you for listening.
How's it going? Nice to see your face. You look younger, I guess.
Yeah, face to face. It's the mountain sunburn. Makes me look a little younger. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're in Colorado, and we're here for the 2018 Basel World Preview with Oris, which is an event they're doing in an area just adjacent to Vail. There's Beaver Creek,
Bachelor Gulch. Yeah, we're actually at the Ritz-Carlton. Yeah. In an eighth floor, really nice suite. It's actually, we're doing a fireside chat.
It's the fanciest space we've ever recorded in, for certainly.
That's for sure, yeah.
And yeah, we've got a nice fireplace, and we've had a really full day. It's it's a tight schedule to come out. It's a short event. You know, it was a Sunday to a Tuesday, and you know, today was Monday, and we spent the morning skiing.
Yeah.
And then we spent the afternoon having some lunch and then looking at watches.
Yeah, it's been a pretty ideal trip. And if we both sound a little breathless, it's because the altitude here in Beaver Creek is at 8,100 feet, according to the maps. I'm not sure what that is in meters, but it makes you a little breathless climbing a flight of stairs, or when we first arrived yesterday, it was took a bit of adjustment. I had kind of a headache until about the wee hours of this morning, but now I'm doing okay. How about you?
Yeah, I'm a sea level boy.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I run around. That's where I do things. So, yeah, you notice it a couple times. I think maybe I'm not as good at breathing as I thought I was, because I'll just sit down and realize I'm a little bit behind on breathing.
Yeah.
And you have to catch up for a moment. But other than that, I mean, skiing, I didn't notice it at all, which is where I thought it would be the hardest.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Yeah.
But I didn't notice it skiing, but you notice it just occasionally. You go to catch your breath and you don't have quite as much in your lungs as you thought you would.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was interesting because we arrived on Sunday, and it was breezy when we flew into the Eagle County Airport here, just up the road from Vail, and it was unseasonably warm for these parts for this time of year. It was, Fahrenheit. It was 50, I think, or thereabouts, and it kind of gave us some concerns about skiing, because you looked up at the mountains and most of them were pretty brown. There were a couple of runs that were just starting to get some snow cover. But we woke up this morning, which was our ski day, and a very brisk 15 Fahrenheit this morning with a nice dusting of snow, and turned out to be just a spectacular day in the mountains.
Yeah, it was kind of mixed cloud, but not warm, not cold.
Yeah.
And there weren't a ton of people out, so we never waited for a lift.
Yeah.
And they had essentially two runs open, but you basically one meandering overall route.
Yeah.
And we just lapped it until we ran out of time. It was great. The weather was awesome, and we had a really good time.
Yeah, so I had done, I don't, it was probably on a Grey NATO about a year ago. I probably talked about my visit to Zermatt with Oris for the similar event last year, and at that time I was very much a novice skier, hadn't skied since high school years, and was kind of just getting back into it, and it sort of the bug bit me right after that trip, and I did a lot of skiing last winter, and so it was fun to come out here and actually do some legitimate mountain skiing. It was challenging. It was a challenging run for me. I mean, I'm still, I would say, pretty much a beginner skier, but we both held our own. I would say it was kind of a hard blue run, I guess.
We had some good tutelage.
Yeah,
some kind instruction.
Yeah, we were skiing with Rolf Studer, who's the co-CEO at Oris, and so it was pretty much the three of us running up and down the lift all day, and we'd go down the runs, James and I feeling pretty good about ourselves, weaving in and out, and then there'd be this
it's like getting passed by a Ferrari.
Go past, and it would be Rolf zipping down the hill, and he'd go down and wait for us a little ways down, and so it was it was great, and Rolf was a pleasure to ski with, and he's actually in the room with us here. We thought we'd bring him in for a couple of questions in a bit here.
Yeah, and there's never a bad day skiing on the mountains. I grew up in Ontario, and of course you're in Minneapolis, and
yeah.
So you're used to runs that last 30 seconds, yeah. A minute,
yeah,
right? If you're cooking, if you know what you're doing, you're down and you're back at a lift again,
yeah.
And you're doing laps basically.
Right, right.
And I mean, even here, you know, it's a lot like Whistler and where you get to go for a bit long enough that you would stop at some points on the way down. Certainly,
yeah,
Rolf has to stop so we can catch up. He's yeah. just a lot faster than we were.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah, you gotta like, you know, catch your breath and sort of shake out your legs a little bit, you know, halfway
especially
downhill.
Especially the first few runs. Yeah,
yeah.
I felt like
yeah.
I had lead in my shoes. So.
Yeah, yeah. But it was great, and it was you know, the sun peaked out. It got just pleasantly warm. You know, you'd warm up a bit going up on the lift, and work up a good sweat coming down, and yeah, it was good. I mean, fun to kind of have a little adventure for a couple of hours. And,
for sure, yeah.
You know, interestingly enough, you know, this was kind of my second Aurus preview event, and I guess one question that we both had was, you know, we saw a lot of watches today. I don't know, maybe a dozen watches or so.
Better part of, yeah.
Yeah. But on this episode, we'll talk about the only one that we can talk about because... there are, you know, all of the others have what in the industry they call embargoed dates, which means that we can't write or talk about these watches until their release dates, or until the dates that the Aurus tells us that it's okay to write anything or discuss them.
Right.
So we'll talk about the one in a minute here, but you know, some really spectacular stuff, and I wish we could talk about it. There were some really neat pieces.
There's a lot to see between now, you know, in the next several months.
Yeah. But we did have a question for Rolf. We're curious about, you know, a lot of the watches that we saw today. The embargo dates coincide with Baselworld in March, and I guess one question we have is, why does Aurus do an event like this annually to preview watches that most of which will not be seen until Basel? What is your kind of strategy for doing a preview event like this every year?
Yeah, Basel is a very busy time. Have a lot of meetings every 30 minutes, every hour another meeting. And if we do a preview event like that, we really get to spend some time together, get really to talk about these watches.
Oh, okay.
You understand, we can really explain what we wanted to achieve with a certain piece and make you understand what our reasons are for doing things the way we do, and I hope we accomplish that today.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but that's a good point. You just you don't get a lot of time at Basel. You're sort of, especially with you, you know, we're meeting with our own geography, you know. So yeah, that's a good point. Of course, you like to ski, so it's a good excuse to get out on the slopes, right?
Well, I didn't want to put this as a first reason, but of course, it's so great to be on the slopes, and we really had a great day today, so yeah. I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah. So speaking of the skiing, how would you compare Zermatt skiing to Beaver Creek skiing? Or just Switzerland to Colorado in general, would you say?
Well, unfortunately, there wasn't so much snow.
Yeah.
And then there were these two runs open.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty comparable.
Yeah.
I really enjoy the scenery here, the ski in the trees.
Yeah.
In these rocky mountains. I think it's fantastic. It's beautiful here.
Yeah.
Looking forward to being in Zermatt next week.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And I'm sure that will be a good time too there.
Yeah. Yeah. So Aurus is doing another of these preview events for kind of the European watch journalists over in Zermatt, Switzerland next week. So yeah, they'll get to have some fun and you'll get to do some more skiing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so the one watch that we were able to talk about today and that we're going to be, you know, writing up here shortly is the Aurus Clipperton Limited Edition, which is kind of a follow-up to your past couple of years. You did something with the Great Barrier Reef. You've done something with the Coral Reef Restoration Foundation, or the Coral Restoration Foundation, and the Hammerhead LE from last year. I don't know, can you just sort of briefly describe the Clipperton edition and kind of what your story behind that, I guess? I mean, we sort of know it from James, you know, he's talked about it on...
Yeah, well, the real expert here is James, right? Because he is the only one of us who actually has been on that island. I think it's a fantastic project, what N2PIX does, trying to create sanctuary around Clipperton Island and even further from the coast to Clipperton Island. And as we know from James, Clipperton Island is really a symbol of what's happening today in the world and in the seas. It's the island is totally remote. It's full of trash.
Yeah.
And we really want to raise awareness for the cause of this island and for the cause of the pollution of the seas. And hope that with this watch and with the contribution we made towards this expedition that we can do that.
I guess I didn't ask this earlier today, but is there a portion of the proceeds going to some sort of a research organization, or was that kind of your underwriting of the trip and this is sort of what comes of it? Or
no, we helped make this trip possible.
Yeah.
By financing part of it.
Yeah.
We also communicate now about it, so we are supporting the projects in different ways and hope that we will be able to help establishing that marine sanctuary between Clipperton Island and the West Coast.
Yeah, yeah. And I should just mention, I guess we could describe the watch. I mean, there'll be plenty of pictures up by the time the episode goes live, but it's a 43.5 millimeter steel cased. It's the Aquas family from Oros, so it's a diving watch. And it has this sort of beautiful, I don't know if you'd call it like a gradient or sort of a radial patterned blue, sort of a beautiful oceanic blue, I guess you'd call it, color that sort of changes depending on which angle you look at the watch. What I really like about it was the engraving on the back, which is the Clipperton Atoll. So there's 2,000 pieces, and it's $2,000 on rubber and $2,200 on the bracelet. And then the other thing about it too that was kind of cool is you mentioned that the packaging, the box that it comes in, is it's made of 30% algae, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that is to kind of one of your efforts to kind of experiment or work with packaging that maybe isn't quite so fossil fuel dependent, right?
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't stop with supporting projects as this Clipperton expedition. We also want to contribute from how we do things and look at all angles in our production chain. And packaging is one of the things where you can change things, try new things. And that's what we want to do with this packaging that's made of 30% algae.
Yeah.
And this way saves oil that's not being used for this plastic.
Well, it's a great piece, and we'll by the time this episode goes up, we'll have an article up on Hodinkee about it, and certainly you can check photos on Instagram and take a look at it. It's really a neat first piece, and it'll be exciting to kind of roll out the other pieces that you showed us today and start talking about those in the coming weeks. So, well, thanks, Rolf. Thanks for the ski lesson today, for letting us slow guys tag along with you. So
yeah, it was really great. Thanks for being here with us, and yeah. All the best.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Rolf.
So yeah, that's a little bit more about Clipperton from Rolf, who helps to run Oros and pick their direction. And certainly I had a long chat with him at dinner last night about kind of the inspiration behind these projects, because to be honest, they pick projects that watch companies maybe shouldn't pick.
Yeah. They're kind of oddball, off the map, almost literally.
How do you make any money back in with the Clipperton thing? Like, they're only going to make 2,000 watches, and the watches cost roughly the same as a normal Aquas.
Right, right.
The dial looks really cool, and that's pretty much what it is dial and a cool case back. And the dial really is like a wave. If you imagine the sunlight hitting a wave, it's all this gradient of blue that fades to this black on the outside.
Right.
And it's kind of iridescent, and it still has the ceramic bezel, and it's the same size. And then beyond that, I mean, it sounds kind of dumb, but we saw a bunch of cool stuff that I'm legitimately excited about, and we took pictures of, and we'll get to write about later. But embargoes being embargoes, you can't really chat about it, so we probably shouldn't.
Yeah, yeah, we don't
want to bob that hook any more than it has been.
Right. I think it's just neat to, there aren't a lot of brands that you get such great access to upper management, and to actually be able to go and ski with Rolf, and then to have him sit in for a bit here and chat with us, and go to dinners and stuff. Oros is one of those brands that I don't know of many, if any, people that don't like Oros. And I think the vibe that they project,
they're just kind of down to earth, even for a Swiss watch, especially among a Swiss watch brand.
It's exactly the vibe you know, for those that haven't met people from Oris, but you know their watches, the vibe of the company and the people that work for it, for the company, is exactly as you'd imagine just by, you know, wearing a watch or looking at the watches or reading about the watches. They're, it's very no-nonsense, very unpretentious, and, you know, to a person, I think the folks that work for them, from, you know, Jamie and PR to, you know, VJ, who's the kind of the U.S. president, and then Rolf up at the top there and over in Switzerland. I just think they're fun-loving people, you know. So it's
and how do you feel after I don't know, maybe we did 10 laps? Well, that's probably about fair.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out how many we did. I mean, we skied for about 3 hours, and you know, I don't know, but my legs are a little stiff now. I'm actually doing surprisingly better than I thought. I was a little scared, you know, that first.
Yeah, there was a steep section that also had like some loose kind of heavier snow sitting on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was right kind of at the top, as I guess you would expect. There was, but it was also tighter. So if there are other people, they're kind of zipping by you right there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at this point, I mean, Rolf is
yeah.
three football fields down the hill, just waiting, leaning on his poles, waiting for us.
Yeah. I mean, it was, so that was a little daunting. After the first run, I thought, I can't do this. This is just, it's too steep. You're looking down over the edge, and it's it looks impossibly steep. But you know, after that first run, my confidence grew each time. And then I would say by the second to last run or so, my legs were starting to feel a little crampy and sort of tight. And I thought, this is where you kind of get into that injury zone where you're, you know, you're not quite ski fit. And your muscles are going to give out at the wrong moment and tear a knee up or
that
something.
That last run of the day.
But it was great. And you know, we finished at you know, about 11:30, and it felt right. It felt like the kind of a good time to end. I mean, I could have certainly had a nice lunch and skied the afternoon as well.
But, for sure,
I didn't mind that there was only one run open today.
No, and then we're on a how many people we figure is in this group? Maybe 12.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's only three of us that opted to ski: you, myself, and Zach Weiss of Warn and Wound.
Yeah, yeah,
and. Zach had a good time, and you and I had a good time. The rest of them went on like a Jeep tour, which sounded fine and fun. And I think they saw some great scenery, of which there's tons here. I mean, everything looks a bit like a postcard.
Yeah, it's really beautiful, and the setting of the Ritz-Carlton here. You know, I mean, the Ritz itself is just it's too fancy
for TGN. I mean, if you could see the room we're sitting in, we couldn't be. You know,
we're in a suite that
more auspicious.
Oris had you know. Booked for the day, I guess, to
do the presentation.
Yeah. So nobody's actually sleeping in this room. In fact, maybe we should take it over.
We're not waking anyone up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was a good spot. But there's this two-sided beautiful fireplace and kind of a buffet table on one side and a bunch of couches and balconies that overlook the pool. And
we got to see basically an explanation of each watch.
Yeah,
and then. An example of each watch, and then once all of them had been explained, we got to take the photos that we'll need to cover them as they become released models.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty fun Grenado sort of day, skiing in the morning. I mean, we had a relatively early start.
It's pretty
got
ideal,
some good
right?
skiing, and then we've seen some watches, and now we're doing a TGM by a fireplace. I mean, maybe a roaring bonfire would have been better. We were by a bonfire last night. It was pretty chilly.
Yeah,
and you would have heard my teeth clattering.
And we're actually drinking some good Blanton's bourbon whiskey here as we're talking. And I was just thinking, you know, as you were saying that, I mean, what's our intro for the show? It's you know, travel, adventure, diving gear, and watches, and we kind of hit almost all of those.
Just trade diving for skiing.
At least there's a and we had a diving watch to talk about. So. It was a good, almost a near perfect TGN day.
Both you and I exhibited a certain faux pas on this trip, in that neither of us have an Oris.
Yes, yes.
So what have you got on wrist?
Well, I've got my Bramont MB2,
the white dial
with the white dial, which
that looks great.
Of course I love. Seemed like a fitting kind of ski watch.
Yep.
And you know, certainly they're a competitor of Oris, but I think you know, it's not. It seemed like a kind of a cool watch to wear on the trip. And, you know, I used to have
this. It's kind of a boss move to wear somebody else's watch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
maybe. I don't know.
I go under the, you know, the auspices of, you know, staying objective. But no, I had one of those, the ProPilot altimeters for a couple of years. And I actually wore that in Zermatt last year and did a fair amount of kind of mountain sports. We did it in Vancouver. I had that watch with me.
Yeah.
And it's still a really cool watch. But I ended up parting ways with that. I had a certain old Land Rover I have to pay for, so a few watches had to leave the stable, and that was sad.
It happens. There's always, and I mean, lots of They have a lot in the lineup right now that I find pretty interesting. I finally got a chance to play with the World Timer.
Yeah.
And this is not embargoed, and it's a watch I've wanted to see for a long time.
Yeah.
It didn't get a lot of fanfare when it was launched, and I think it's because they didn't explain exactly what the function, like the functionality is explained through a little video.
Right.
But there's a tactile element.
Yes.
So for those of you that don't know this watch, it's a, I think it's 44.5 millimeters,
mm-hmm.
yep. 44 or 45 millimeters is right in there. Steel Pro Pilot. And what it does is it has a world time feature where you have a sub dial at 3 that has an entirely independent display of hours and minutes,
mm-hmm.
as well as an AM PM scale.
Yeah.
And that's your home time all the time.
Yeah.
And when you fly or you change time zones, you actually, move the bezel, but it's on a spring action. So you're not turning the bezel around.
Right.
It kind of has, let's say it goes 10 degrees in one direction and 10 degrees in the other. And when you hit 10 degrees to the right, the big hour hand jumps an hour forward.
Yeah.
And it'll bring the date with it, which is excellent if you've had any ETA-based, quote-unquote, GMT watch. The date will be tied, of course, not to the 24-hour hand, but the main hand, whereas this will tell you the date where you're going.
Right, right.
Which is like an Explorer 2 will do the same thing and
yeah.
and that sort of thing. And the actual functionality, it's a big watch. It's a little bigger than the sort of watch I would wear, and I would love to see them miniaturize it
right.
to their 40 millimeter Pro Pilot, which yeah. is such a great size to begin with.
Yeah.
But that actual like hands-on turning that bezel or wiggling that bezel, because it's not really turning it, you're rotating it, but yeah. it only rotates yeah. a little bit, and then it kind of bounces back to center.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old rewind levers on a like,
yeah,
film
exactly
camera.
Yeah, or like on a VCR, those ones, you know, like yes. the scrub forward, scrub back.
Yes, it there's a tactile detent, like a click as you
right
rotate
at the
it,
end,
and then it
yeah.
snaps back, and it's very satisfying to use. And we were joking because we took the watch off of VJ's wrist. He's the Oris U.S. president, and he was wearing it. And I think by the time we gave it back to him, I mean, he couldn't tell what time it was.
I'm sure it was off by 6 hours. Of it and just playing with it.
Yeah, but what's neat about that watch to me is that I love the Pro Pilot aesthetic. I love that. I don't even know how you describe it. Sort of this, it has this vaguely sort of aviation, sort of radial. Engraved bezel.
Oh, like the, it's like bezel. A turned bezel of some sort.
Yeah.
Yeah, they look cool.
What's neat about it is that they took that bezel, which on every other Pro Pilot, Big Crown Pro Pilot, it's fixed. And they actually made it functional and made it so that you could turn that. And it's, I'm sure that years back when they came out with that Pro Pilot bezel, they didn't intend it to be grippy to turn or anything like that.
Yeah.
But it suddenly is perfect for that without having to resort to like a dive style bezel or something with, you know.
And the movement is one that they've had. It's their module.
Yeah.
And it's one that they've had on their push button world timer GMT plus minus watches.
Right.
And, you know, this is a watch I've hunted for years. And if you're listening and you have what's called a BC Solo,
yeah,
preferably a blue dial, they're 40 millimeter sport watches from Oris. I would say they're about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And on the lower lug, so like at 4 and at like 8, they had a button. And if you press the 4 o'clock one, you went ahead an hour. And if you press the 8 o'clock one, you went back an hour.
Yeah.
And you had this little sub display of your home time zone. So they're just essentially removing the buttons and making it in this sort of trigger like bezel
yeah.
where it clicks and then it goes back to, it's cool. I mean like yeah, it's the exact sort of this. I remember with that IWC that had a similar functionality, the Pilot time zoner.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was the time zoner.
Time
I think.
Zoner.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right.
Whereas that one, it ratcheted. It turned all the way around. And with each click, it made another
right.
move of the hand.
And I think it had the world cities
it
on had the way.
And it could yeah. account for summer DST, which was
right.
pretty clever.
Right.
But
right.
it was also probably 3 millimeters thicker than the Oris.
Yeah,
and it was 45 watch. Millimeters wide. It was like 18 yeah. millimeters thick.
And quite a bit more expensive.
Yeah. And I remember gushing about that because, I mean,
yeah.
I'm long on record on this show and in a lot of stuff I've written. I love GMT watches and
yeah.
I love world time functionalities.
Yeah.
And I just think it's really cool when someone finds a way. And I love push button. You know, I would prefer the Explorer 2 to have been a push button compared to pulling the crown out and
yeah.
finding that first position,
yeah.
advancing it. It works fine. It's very elegant.
Yeah.
But the functionality of just kind of the way doing it in the bezel makes so much sense. I mean, even Rolex has moved the functionality in the Sky Dweller
right.
to the bezel.
Yeah.
And theirs is a 3 position, I believe, where you're basically at 11, noon, or 12 and deciding what feature's being changed.
Right.
I think that's how that works.
Yeah.
I haven't actually had a chance to play with a running Sky Dweller. They're always, the ones you see at Basel are always like dummies.
Yeah, right.
The movements are
right.
dummies or they're plastic or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by these movements, and I really like that a brand like Oris, which is a, you know, they're attempting to make watches that regular people would buy and use.
Yeah.
And I think I travel a lot and I see that functionality, and if you put in a slightly smaller watch, I'm on board. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the neat thing about Oris. I mean, their complications tend to be clever in their simplicity.
They have so many now.
It's like they seek the not the easy way, but the more simple way to do something. You know, whether it's the
straightforward, step gauge, accessible, yeah.
You know, that uses water pressure to indicate depth, or the mechanical altimeter, you know, pointer date, you know, this kind of stuff. And it's their watches have always kind of had that element to them. It's sort of a running theme, and I think this is the same way. And I think that World Time Pro Pilot is neat because it's so subtle. You look at that watch and it could just be like any sort of two time zone watch, you know.
It's not overpowered because you don't have to put a bunch of text on the dial to explain what button to press or to show a bunch of other cities. Like, they avoided all that. You could claim it's technically not a world timer, as it doesn't show the time zone in all.
Right.
Doesn't show the time in all time zones.
Yeah.
Which is accurate. It's not a world timer.
Yeah.
But the functionality and the ability, obviously, to run the date and to run the time.
Yeah.
And maintain your home time zone and the AM PM at home is cool. And it works.
It's cool. I think these, you know, the time zoner, world timer, GMT name has been a bit overused, well, not overused, but misused,
watered,
I guess,
to down a certain or something.
Watered,
yeah,
down, I guess, is the term. But
I mean, that's, you know, how it is in a lot of these names. But I think, at least to my understanding,
yeah,
or in my mind, if you're going to say something's a world timer, it has to have the ability to show you all the time zones,
right,
or as many time zones as possible.
Yeah,
you know, think of stuff from Patek or that GP 1966.
Yeah,
world timer. The Seiko's passive.
Yeah.
You have to set the bezel yourself.
Right.
But once it's set, it's a world timer for an hour.
Right.
Until the hand, you know, moves on. But
I
think it's a great functionality and yet another like useful and nicely implemented complication.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, we saw, you know, Rolf was wearing a Karl Brashear, you know, one of the limited edition watches from last year that had that beautiful blue dial, and he was wearing that skiing and you know, he said he uses that kind of as a sports watch. He normally wears one of the caliber 112s or 113s, but he wears this for his kind of sporting opportunities. And he was wearing that, so it has a nice patina to it. It kind of has that nice green. It's just a cool watch. We were sitting outside for lunch today, and just to see that, the way that thing's kind of patinaed. You know, for a while there, I thought bronze watches were a little bit, I don't know, not for me, a little bit gimmicky, but the more I see them, like a nicely patinaed one, it's pretty cool.
They look good. They look good when they've got some age on them.
Yeah.
And I mean, that Brashear, they all sold out.
Yeah.
They're gone.
Right.
And you don't see them that commonly unless you're on Instagram and you know who to follow and that kind of thing. And definitely a neat piece. And yeah, I think you see them all clean and shiny, and it's kind of like, I'd rather it be steel.
Right.
And then you see it all kind of gunked up a bit, and the other colors are coming through, and then they make more sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know that like Halios had done a bunch of different samples with the bronze Tropics.
Yeah.
With different types of accelerated patina.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
By like encasing the watch in various, like above and in the gases of various chemicals.
Yeah.
And one of them, and I'd have to double check with Jason what it was, but it was like a very smooth, very even, almost black finish.
Oh.
It looked incredible.
Huh, interesting.
In like direct light, there was more color in the curve of the case, but otherwise it was like an inky, almost like gas on top of water.
Oh, nice.
Sort of color. It was really neat. So, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that you can do by using different chemicals and vinegar, and you know, you can read all sorts of these things on Watch You Seek as guys test out and then clean the watch. It goes back to normal, and then they start over again with a different type of treatment. So that's kind of fun. I said it's like getting a watch with a project or something like that. So,
yeah, it was fun to just kind of hang out with a number of people that we don't see that often. I mean, I haven't really spent this much time with Zach from Worn and Wound. You know, we had some nice chats with him and Josh from Watchinista.
Josh from Watchinista, yeah, for sure. So. Adam's here from Red Bar and
Ariel
from A Blog to Watch. It's a good crew.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's always nice. Yeah, it's always nice to catch up with those types. And then before we kind of move on to other new business and stuff like that, I would make sure that if you're listening to this and you don't know what Clipperton is or any of that, the backstory, very briefly, it was an expedition I went on earlier this year via Oris to a coral atoll near the equator, north of the equator, but very far south of certainly where I've ever been.
Yeah.
And I won't go into really any detail because we did a whole show devoted to it. So that's episode 35. You can go back on SoundCloud or in your podcast aggregator, episode 35 from Clipperton with Love. And if you need to know more about Clipperton or if you have any questions, you can always email me, thegreennato@gmail.com.
Yeah, it was a cool story, and I was glad to hear that there was some follow-up to it at this point. I mean, it had been months since we'd talked about it. And
yeah, for sure.
You know, I've seen photos. There was something in, I think, the Explorers Club Journal came out about the expedition, and then I saw something, might have been in Divers Alert Network magazine or something. And so these things pop up every now and then, but it was neat to see that they've acknowledged that trip, you know, here at the beginning of 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly gives you something to look back on and, you know, revisit seeing this watch, and you'd give a nice little talk to the group here today. So,
yeah, it was an amazing experience, and not something I'll ever get to do again.
Yeah.
Most likely. So, it's something I'm definitely, very humbled and happy to have had, and even any part. And, you can still go back and find the fairly large, probably the largest thing I ever wrote for a blog to watch, on a blog to watch. And that was called, 16 days, two watches, one forgotten island.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But, what do you think? You got anything new to chat about? I guess this is where we can branch out beyond the confines of Vail Valley.
You know, so last time we spoke, I mean, I had just returned from Bonaire a couple of days earlier, and then it was, you know, our Thanksgiving holiday in the U.S. and,
For sure.
And, you know, I think the last episode I had talked that, I was still hand crank starting my old Land Rover, waiting for the starter motor to come in. Well, that was a successful operation. The new starter motor went in the day before Thanksgiving, so a couple Wednesdays ago. And
almost seems like cheating now. You just turn a key.
It's a luxury, you know. It's all your perspective, right? I mean, when you're hand cranking
the car, like 30 years younger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's, you know, the weather's starting to get a little colder, and you know, I'm happy to notice that the heat is blowing pretty well on that thing. So, you know, if I don't want to turn every new business on the show into my Land Rover adventures, but it seems like every week there's some new you know, thing to learn about. But it's just been fun to kind of you know, get something I guess outside of watches to kind of geek out on. And I'm a complete novice with these vehicles, and it's just kind of fun to kind of visit new forums. Mm-hmm. You know, after years of going to watch forums, it's kind of fun to be the new guy on an old Land Rover forum and meet some new friends and just tinker a bit. So, so starter motor, you know, operation was successful, and, you know, knock on wood, it'll get me through the winter without too many issues. So.
For sure. Well, I mean, speaking of, you know, cars and bits that go inside them, I had a pretty wild trip to Belgium. I previewed it on the last episode.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was a zombie on that trip. I hope. I don't even remember some of the conversations I had. I just remember sitting at tables and talking, but I'd been awake for so long by the time we got to Belgium, I didn't even want to drive the car. I'd already driven the Panamera. So this is the trip, for those of you who listened to last episode. This is a trip with Porsche to a place called Galaxy Studios in Belgium to preview a new stereo that Porsche had worked on with Boromeister, which is a Berlin-based manufacturer of very high-end audio equipment, home stereos.
Yeah.
And they make the premium sound option in almost all Porsches, but for the Cayenne and the Panamera, due to their size and their ability to cram speakers everywhere, they have this new one, which is a 3D surround sound stereo that uses some technology that was developed at Galaxy Studios, which is this world-renowned recording and mastering facility.
Huh.
They have a room in Galaxy Studios where they record all sorts of orchestra work and piano work that has a noise floor of 14 dB.
What does that mean?
Like,
it's
very quiet inside a car is like 60 dB.
Oh, okay.
And a whisper is like 30.
Okay.
Like the kind of whisper where you have to put your mouth close to somebody's ear.
Right, right.
So I've never experienced the type of silence that a 14, like, so the entire facility is on springs.
Yeah.
Which isolates any noise above 3 hertz, any frequency above 3 hertz.
Yeah.
And then they have like multiple panels of 11 centimeter thick glass in the walls. They had to develop a special crane thing to lift the panels of glass.
Wow.
Didn't exist because the glass didn't exist.
Huh.
But instead of layering all these types of glass, which could have resonance between them.
Yeah.
It's one thick piece of glass like you would use if you were designing a huge aquarium.
Oh, yeah.
And the room, like, so they gave us a tour in the of this room, and the room's quiet even when people are talking in it. It's weird.
Yeah.
Cause, and that's 14 dB with the AC on.
Oh, wow.
So they said that it gets, like, even quieter if you decide why you would do this, but it gets so quiet. Like, 14 dB, the microphones don't matter. Like, it's not going to pick up.
Yeah.
And so they, like, walked us into the room, and we listened to a very talented pianist play a song, and then the gentleman who had helped design the room spoke about it at length, and then he said, get very comfortable on your feet, and don't move your bags or anything, and just hold your breath. And, I mean, all I could hear was the inside of my brain. Like, just my tinnitus, my slight tinnitus.
Yeah.
And, like, the heartbeats of other people in the room. Like, it was insanely quiet.
Wow.
Disturbingly, upsettingly quiet.
Yeah.
And then we saw a bunch of recording facilities. We saw where they master movies for various types of theaters.
Huh.
So we saw where they mastered the sound for Blade Runner 2049
and
all this type of stuff. And then, you know, we had driven from Brussels Airport to Galaxy Studios, maybe 2 hours the route that pours this kind of meandering route through the Belgian countryside. I was too tired to drive, but I wasn't too tired to play with the stereo the whole way.
Oh, yeah.
The stereo is unbelievable.
Huh.
I mean, it should be. It's 60, 68, 70 Canadian.
Wow.
$7,000.
Yeah.
And like there's a bass stereo in these cars, and then you can option the Bose.
Yeah.
Which also comes with higher spec versions of the cars, and then the Bormeisters.
Wow.
That, like, pinnacle.
Yeah.
And the take rate's probably, like, around 10% of vehicles.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if it's a $220,000 car,
right,
would you rather have $10,000 ceramic brakes on your family sedan or the best stereo?
Right.
Well, I'd buy the stereo.
Right, right.
And so it has a bunch of tech to basically make you feel like the sound's coming from different places in the car. There's 21 speakers. It's 1,500 watts.
Wow.
And when I threw my phone on Spotify, it sounded amazing. And then they had like SD cards full of lossless music.
Yeah.
And then it's unbelievable how clear and how loud you could listen to it.
Yeah.
The mirrors are moving. Nothing in the car rattles.
Yeah.
That must have been a huge engineering. Like, don't get me wrong. It's a new Porsche, $200,000 car. Nothing should rattle.
Right.
But
still,
nothing's rattling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
you'd think you'd get that boom, you know.
Nothing like that. None of the weird humming or buzzing.
Yeah.
The glass isn't like moving around. The rearview mirror is not moving around so much. It's like just the wing mirror. You could kind of see it when the bass really hit.
Yeah.
Speakers everywhere. And you can kind of shape the 3D sound to your liking and its positioning. But with the 3D element on, it genuinely sounds like there's no walls to the car.
Huh.
Like the sound's coming from much further away.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic. A really neat experience. Cause I've heard some nice speakers. That Maserati I drove had a Bowers and Wilkins that I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
Not in the same league.
Yeah.
And then after that, we had a demo from Bormeister of €170,000 stereo.
Yeah.
Two speakers, couple amps and like something, a network player. They had like two things to play the file the cleanest way.
Yeah.
I've never heard anything like that.
Wow. Wow.
Like live doesn't sound that good.
Interesting trip for, you know, presumably this was as part of your car coverage.
Yeah, for Nuvo. Yeah, piece is on Nuvo, NuvoMagazine.com.
But it's an interesting angle because, you know, so often automotive articles focus on the ceramic brakes or the engine tweak or, you know, the stitching on the seats or something. That would be an interesting trip, even though you were horribly
I was unbelievably tired. And then at the end, they like hand me the keys to Panamera turbo wagon and they're like okay, the route is more direct, it's just on the highway back to the airport, park it at the airport, go home. And I was like, nah, I've been up for like 40 hours at this point.
Yeah,
can I just have a ride with somebody else?
Yeah.
And so I rode back with this German auto writer. He played death metal the whole way.
on the Bormeister
yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. We were in like a chalk gray e-hybrid Panamera.
Wow.
I mean, lovely cars.
Yeah.
but I'm just a fantastic stereo. And now I'm like, is there other places in Vancouver I could go to hear really high end stereos? I just want to hear more of them.
Yeah, right.
Because that the like, don't get me wrong. I think they said once if you wanted to buy that 170,000 euro one and get it all the way to North America,
yeah,
it's like 300 grand.
Yeah,
300 grand.
Yeah,
it's absurd. But the experience is pretty absurd too.
Yeah,
I would never aspire to own one or buy one or spend that kind of money on a stereo. But like, if you could walk into a store in your city or your town and hear something like that,
yeah,
please do it.
Right,
go find your favorite band, and if it's Wolfpack, you can go like to their base camp and buy their FLAC, the FLAC files or the lossless files.
Yeah,
go buy some high bitrate versions of three or four of your favorite songs. It'll cost you $5.
Yeah.
And then go to a hi-fi store and actually hear what they sound like,
because
it's bonkers.
Huh. Do you think they'd, would they make a version of that for my Land Rover, do you think?
Oh, probably. Oh, I mean, you can get like a almost all of these, I mean, Bormeister doesn't. They're very like pure in their thinking.
Yeah.
But almost all of the really high-end, quote-unquote high-end stereo manufacturers make like some Bluetooth stereo.
Yeah. Yeah.
You should get like a Bluetooth.
Sure.
Bowers and Wilkins.
Oh, yeah.
Nice neo modern.
Yeah.
Would really look the part.
I'm sure nothing would rattle.
Velcroed to the dash of the.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing would rattle. I'm sure if I turned it up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. No. Yeah. There's definitely nothing that's going to rattle in that car. But yeah. So that was really, really cool. And I think the takeaway for the normal person that's not buying Porsches with $7,000 stereos is if you have the opportunity at a listening gallery or to try a really good pair of headphones, like just try the experience.
Yeah.
It's a really fun experience.
Yeah.
Especially if you know the song and you can start hearing things you haven't heard before. Don't bring like a Grenado. You're just going to hear like lip noises or blinking sounds. I have no idea what other sounds are hiding somewhere in these recordings, but you know, pick a really cool track that you love and try it on the most expensive stereo you can find. It's just fun for the 10 minutes. And I honestly think it doesn't change the way I feel about my home stereo, which is worth maybe at best a couple grand when it was brand new.
Yeah.
And I still listen to that and love it. It's fine, but it is a fun experience.
Now, wouldn't that be something if there was some guy cruising down the Autobahn in this Panamera listening to Grenado on his Bormeister right now?
Turn it off, man.
Yeah, right.
Put on some Wolfpack.
Yeah.
Or whatever, something else.
I
heard some, I'm not even a fan of the Eagles, and they had like Hotel California.
Oh, I bet that sounds good. That it opening guitar.
And they had some stuff by Banks. I don't know.
Huh.
Some people know Banks, some don't. But Banks is a fantastic artist. And
it
was really amazing. The lossless stuff on the right stereo, you can hear the difference.
Yeah.
So it's cool.
Huh.
Nice. Definitely a fun trip, and I was really thrilled to be writing about something that was like car adjacent, and still nerdy, but not it's this fast, I went this fast, I braked this hard, or is this track like all of that's great, but it's so nice to have something that's from the other side and still like hugely obsessively engineered. They had all the little pieces of the whole stereo on a table, and everything's custom.
Yeah.
Like obviously, but like to a very high degree to fit, like the subwoofer surround curls around the spare tire.
Oh. Huh.
So it has like a custom fitted box for the spare tire just for that.
Wow.
Panamera or Cayenne.
Yeah.
Some really neat stuff.
Huh.
And multiple amps and weird solid state speakers that sit in the dash and push sound off of the windshield so that it sounds like it's coming from in front of you.
Oh, sure.
Like a sound stage.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, I've rambled extensively at this point, but I had a really cool time. And if you can walk into a Porsche dealer and just and see if they'd have one of the cars there, I'm sure they'd be thrilled just to see somebody walk in to check out an $8,000 option. So why not, right? Certainly cooler than the ceramic brakes.
Yeah.
How you feeling about a little final notes, and we'll put a bow on this before dinner time?
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah, what have you got for us? Well, I'll jump in here first. You know, we've certainly talked in past episodes about Ben Saunders, who happens to be a Braymont ambassador, and who I interviewed just before he left for his transantarctic expedition, which was in an Outside Magazine's website about a month ago. Ben's a bit of a hero of ours. We both met him when we were in London last year, and he's in the thick of his transantarctic expedition right now. And if you follow him on social media, whether it's Facebook or Instagram, his team is putting up photos that he's taking and kind of little blurbs, excerpts from his daily blog, and then they provide links that you can go to his website, bensaunders.com, and there's, you know, this daily tracking and daily blog updates from Ben from Antarctica. And I think he's about, what would he be, about a month into it now, I would say, maybe 20 to 25 days. And it's a little bit, you know, reading his blog entries, he's actually quite a good writer, which is kind of fun because he comes up with these interesting sort of links or metaphors or sort of pop culture references when he's talking about, you know, the suffering and the kind of rotten weather and horrible conditions he's going through. And so it's good reading. It's short reading, certainly, but I check it every day.
It's good. I like the post quite a bit. I would agree that they're easy to read and well-written and fun and maybe too fun for a guy that's doing something like the hardest thing ever.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I know. You'd think it would just be like four or five words, most of them swears.
Yeah. And well, we'll see when he gets to day.
Talk to you soon.
You know, day 60. But, you know, it's roughly a 1,000-mile trip, and I think he's, you know, I was looking the other day and he's still, you know, they show like miles to go and it's like 861 miles and I just cringe. I'm like, oh, you know, every day he's going, you know, 15 miles or something. And it's like, just, it seems so painstakingly slow, but, you know, he knows what he's doing. So, yeah.
Good, one foot good in front of the other.
Out. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, my first one, I guess my only one actually this week, haven't come across a ton of stuff, just been kind of underwater with various projects and stuff. But this is a really fun video for anyone that's on the SR-71 kind of hype team with me. And The Drive published a write-up about a video where a pilot gives a cockpit tour of all of the gauges and controls in an SR-71.
So cool.
And I mean, I've sat in the cockpit or a faux cockpit of an SR-71 of a trainer at the Air and Space Museum outside of Seattle. And this is really, really cool. It's a 20-minute video, so it's a little longer than your coffee break, but maybe you could cut it up into a couple viewings or whatever.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. It's almost like vlog style, guys holding the camera, pointing at gauges. But like it's not so much what the gauge does, it's the next thing that he says, as the numbers or the metric that they're measuring relates to some aspect of piloting.
Oh, sure.
The most amazing plane that ever existed.
Yeah.
It's a really great video and I highly recommend it. Like I said, if you're on the kind of never-ending love wave of the SR-71 that I am, I think you definitely get a kick out of this. It's obviously less generally informative than your normal SR-71 documentary.
Right.
Or a chat with a pilot. It's much more like...
This is probably level 3 of geekdom, SR-71. Yeah, this isn't like level 1, you watch the kind of the overview of the history of the SR-71.
We all know how fast it is. Yeah, we all know bleeds fuel when it sits on the tarmac. None of this. I want to know what all these... There's cages and buttons everywhere.
Yeah.
It's 20 minutes well spent. Really fun.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. My second one is... it's a video that I found... one of our favorite websites, Adventure Journal, and they had put up an article kind of linked out to this. It's a video called Lucky Strike, and it's on Vimeo, and it was put together. It was these two buddies, two Kiwis, two New Zealanders who are avid cavers. They've kind of set out to link up two cave systems in New Zealand, and you know, it's a caving video. I mean, it's really cool. But what's neat about it is I like these two guys because they're super chill and they're just kind of like, I mean, I hate to say it, they're kind of like you and I. They're kind of these guys who just, you know, they're talking about it like we talk about our days skiing
for sure.
And yet they're doing this really ambitious caving project that they've got where they're kind of linking up two sides.
And the footage from in the cave is wild.
It is. It's really good. They're
digging around in tiny holes full of mud.
Yeah.
And then it cuts them like smiling or laughing or kind of shoving mud at each other.
I love when they're like cleaning their gear off. Like they come out after a day of caving, they're like hosing it off. And it's just this like clay.
Yeah. But they look thrilled through the whole thing and they're kind of teasing each other.
Yeah.
It's a great video. It's not too long.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess that's about all we've got for the Colorado adventure episode.
Yeah.
Obviously really nice to see you face to face and have a chat. That's a treat that we really only get.
Yeah, I think maybe it's only once the fourth or twice time a year. We've done it. Yeah, I know. It's great.
So as always, thanks so much for listening. You can hit the show notes for more details and links. You can follow us on Instagram at Jason Heaton and at J.E. Stacy, and you can follow the show at The Greynado. That's also where we do all of our giveaways. If you have any questions for us, please write thegreynado@gmail.com, and please subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from the British adventurer John Ridgway, who was quoted on Ben Saunders' blog recently. "Don't stare into the abyss of self-pity. Short, hard tug on the shoelaces and get on with it."